Hello, everyone. This is Jim Conda, Jr. We're interviewing Christopher John Bjerknes, who's a tremendous author and writer. We're going to talk to him about Hitler and World War II. So in 1999, 23 years ago, Dr. Paul Rusnowski, who was a MD and an anesthesiologist, he called me and I said, I want you to do a video on Hitler and the Nazis. And when he told me what his research showed, I thought he had known him for 10 years, and I thought he had maybe gone off the deep end. But when he sent it to me, I thought, well, this answers all my questions about World War II. So I did a video in 2003, thanks to a cameraman that came through and said, sit down, we're doing the video, and you got your box of stuff there. If we don't do it now, you'll probably never do it, and he's probably right. But I did the video. 2 hours and 22 minutes. It's at HitlerDVD.com, among other places. That's an anti-Hitler website. And his thesis was that Hitler was paid by the international bankers, Wall Street, which was known by many, but that his job was to round up and incentivize originally and then round up as many Jews as possible to get as many as possible into Palestine so that the Zionist Jewish faction could take over Palestine and make it Israel. Hitler disappeared from the world stage in 1945, and Israel was founded 3 years later in 1948 because there were enough Jews down there then, about 800,000 from Europe, thanks to primarily to Hitler, and also they got a lot of the Arab countries. They worked with them to persecute the Jews out of the Arab countries into Palestine. So then in 2007, Christopher John Bjerknes, our guest, and me were on, we would call in to Daryl Bradford Smith's show in Europe, which was a very useful show at that time. And I noticed how well-informed Christopher was. Well, he called me in 2007, and we did a three-hour, it was be an hour, but it ended up to be a three-hour interview because he knew as much about the subject as I did. And we talked about this whole thesis of Dr. Rusnowski's in the original video. And I think that Christopher kindly gave me credit in one of his books that he learned about this from hearing me on the show in Europe I'll cut this out. What was the name? I'm forgetting the name of the guy in Europe that we were on his show.
It was Daryl Bradford Smith.
Yeah, yeah.
I actually learned about this from I learned about you from Daryl Bradford Smith.
Right.
But what got me started, and I had published a book a year before then called The Manufacture and Sale of St. Einstein, in which
right.
I said that Nazism was Zionism and Zionism was Nazism, that they were the same thing. And I had learned about it from Henneke Kardell's book, Adolf Hitler, Founder of Israel, and Leni Brenner's book, Zionism in the Age of the Dictators and 51 Documents.
Right,
and
right. That, okay, so you had seen
Klaus
that.
Klaus Polkin article. I had not only seen it, but I had written. I came up with the exact same conclusions, and I think even stronger than Dr. Rusnowski.
Yeah. Now, what did you say about me in the one introduction to the book then? You said something about the video, or you said something about
it. Yes, I recommended your video, which was published 3 years before my book.
Okay.
In 2003. I didn't publish about this until 2006, but I did. Unfortunately, I didn't learn about you until I heard you on Daryl Bradford Smith's show.
Oh, okay. I had
been talking about this for a year on Daryl Bradford Smith's show, and I suspect that someone then realized, hey, this is what Jim Conda Jr. has been saying for years. And he got Smith to get you on. And then I watched your wonderful video. And you had many sources that I wasn't aware of because you were involved in those circles that I didn't know about.
Yeah, and actually like, most of those were Dr. Rusnowski's. But so I may include this, what we just did. I may include what we just talked about here in the show because I can edit whatever we want, and that's good. Okay, so let's then talk about, and then Dr. Rusnowski died today. I don't know if it was the date, but it was the day before Easter, Holy Saturday, 2009. Hard to believe. So since then, Christopher John Bergness has written many books on this subject, drawing it out. Thank God somebody did, because this is a big, big subject. And I say one of the two greatest deceptions of the 20th century, the other one being the takeover of the Vatican in 1958, which I may talk about elsewhere. But after we did our three-hour video, a guy in the Netherlands uploaded that, our three-hour audio. It's actually an audio made into a YouTube video, which is at HitlerDVD.com. Guy in the Netherlands uploaded that to YouTube in the European Union in 2012, 5 years after we did the interview. And then in 2013, a French judge said that it was banned from the his YouTube channel was banned from the European Union and our video. And that fellow, who I think his name was Hanko Ellerbus, said, this video of Bjerknes and Condit must be more dangerous truth than all the other videos I had up. And he had everybody from David Icke to David Irving, you name it, because this is the only time I've ever had my YouTube channel in the European Union taken down. So anyway, I always say to people, try to get an anti-Hitler DVD or audio, an anti-Hitler audio banned in the European Union. You know, that's pretty hard to do because they love anti-Hitler. But this tells the truth that is not known by hardly anybody still. And so most people, and I said, well, when he asked me to do the video, Christopher, I said, why me? Why not get somebody that's well-known like David Irving, or I named a few others, Mark Weber? And he said, because all those guys secretly think Hitler was a great guy, or some people think Hitler was a walking demon. Everything he did was wrong. I want the exact truth to get out there. So I did it for him in 2003. And let's talk about the incredible. You were debating this guy using the name Wise. I can't remember his first name, but
Dennis Wise.
Dennis Wise. That, he's using that name as a stage name, I think. And you debated him on Adam Green on the subject of his six-hour video, The Greatest Story Never Told, which is an encomium of pure praise to Hitler. And you destroyed him in that debate. But the fact that I learned listening to it that I never heard before, tell us about the Jewish state by the founder.
Theodor Herzl.
Yeah, Theodor Herzl, the founder of modern Zionism in 1896. Tell us what is said in that book. It like predicts Hitler and Germany the way it became.
In that book, he said that anti-Semites would be the best friends of the Zionists and would help them to force Jews to emigrate to Palestine. And he said that there can be no peaceful coexistence between Jews and Gentiles, because when Jews become rich, they use the power of the purse to oppress Gentiles. And when Jews become poor, they become the revolutionary element, which imposes Bolshevism on the Gentiles. He didn't use the word Bolshevism because it didn't exist at that time, but he used the idea that the impoverished Jewish classes were revolutionary forces that were antagonistic to the Gentiles. And he said that the only possible resolution would be for separation and for the Jews to form a nation of their own. And then they could then cooperate with other nations. And he established a plan as to how to bring this about. And this is 1896, when Hitler was still a young child. He said that he would petition the anti-Semitic governments of Europe to set up trade companies, which would trade with the Zionists to make it profitable for them to expel Jews down to Palestine, and that they would utilize the funds of the emigrating Jews to pay for the entire enterprise, and then that would also benefit the Gentile societies, because they could then take the place of the Jewish professionals who had been essentially forcibly displaced to emigrate to Palestine. Now, when Hitler came to power in 1933, the Zionists approached him with what was called the Ha'avar Agreement, which is now known as the Transfer Agreement, which was exactly what Herzl had proposed in 1896, to transfer the Jews from the anti-Semitic state of Germany to Palestine. the wealth of the Jews would be appropriated by the German government. Some of it would be given back to the Jews once they had been transferred to Palestine. And Germany, which was under an international boycott and severe economic pressure, would then receive funds from these emigrating Jews to help finance Hitler and the struggling Nazi government. It was exactly what Herzl had proposed. And he proposed creating a friendship between anti-Semites and Zionists.
But he also said that the – didn't he also say that the motivation to for the world to support the Jews having their own country in Israel would be to have an anti-Semitic leader of an anti-Semitic country, you know, cause the Jews to emigrate in one way or another to Palestine?
Absolutely, yes. That was the whole thrust of the book that he wrote and what he was proposing.
Okay,
was
so
that the anti-Semites would be the means by which the Zionists would force the Jewish masses to emigrate out of Europe down into Palestine.
Okay, so is it
and
fair?
He viewed that as a very good thing, as a very welcome thing.
Right.
Because Jews were beginning to assimilate with non-Jews, anti-Semitism was disappearing. And they were fearful that the Jewish race would miscegenate with Europeans and essentially disappear.
And Hitler, when he got into power, he shut down all the newspapers and I believe jailed all the Jewish newspapers and jailed all the Jewish editors of those papers, except the Zionist paper, which was kept open and thriving. And really, the Zionist paper did not have much support, because people, it's like somebody saying to me, do you want to go down and live in Antarctica? We got a really good thing going down there. I say, well, my family's here. I've lived here my whole life. Nobody was that eager to go down into the sands in the hot sand, you know, desert and fight the Muslims for the rest of their life or fight the Palestinians. So they weren't, Zionism, as I understand, was not going anywhere until Hitler started screaming anti-Semitism.
Absolutely, yes. And you touched on many vital issues there. It's true that the only political newspaper that was permitted in the totalitarian Nazi state was a Zionist newspaper.
You mean for Jews?
For any, there were no other political parties allowed to publish party organs except for the Zionist Jews.
Wow. Okay.
And the Zionist Jews were the only ones allowed to fly a non-Nazi flag, their own Zionist flag. And they were permitted to have Zionist organizations and wear Zionist uniforms, which was also streng verboten for regular Germans. So they were privileged above regular German Gentiles.
Okay. Now,
and what happened was World War I freed up Palestine through the Balfour Declaration for Jewish emigration. It also freed up the Jews of Eastern Europe who were trapped in the Pale of Settlement in the Russian Empire through the Soviet Union. Those Jews were then free to emigrate if they so choose. But very, very few chose to take advantage of that situation and go to Palestine. So the Zionist dreams were deflated and they thought that Zionism was dying. And they desperately needed to implement Herzl's plan to put anti-Semitic governments in power, to force those reluctant Jews to emigrate out of Europe and travel to Palestine. They wanted to incentivize the emigration. And the means that they utilized to incentivize emigration was to put Hitler in power and start screaming against the Jews.
Uh-huh. And there's a picture that we have published. I think it was from one of the Palestinian, not the Palestinian, but the Muslim organizations call, and I can't remember the name of it now, but it was like Understanding the Truth About the Middle East. That was the gist of the title of the magazine. But they had a picture of a boat leaving Germany in like 1935. And on the boat, on the masthead, was the Nazi flag, and then the swastika and so forth, and underneath that was the Israeli flag, you know, the Star of David and so forth, on the same ship, because they were going down to Palestine. And then Goebbels in 1935, I believe, also issued a coin that was Zionist on the one side and Nazism on the other.
Adolf Eichmann and General von Mildenstein were both Zionists. Hennecke Gardel suggested that Eichmann was 100% Jewish. Eichmann, in his own statements throughout the course of the war and after the war, said that he was a committed Zionist. And Eichmann was sent down to help facilitate the cooperation of the transfer agreement between the German Nazis and the Palestinian Zionists. And Goebbels' newspaper, Der Angriff, published an article reporting on what Mildenstein was doing, and that coin was issued in connection with that article to celebrate the idea that a Nazi was traveling to Palestine for the benefit of the Zionists.
And the book you referred to just there, Gardel, was called Adolf Hitler, Founder of Israel, right?
Yes, and it was published in German, and there was an inadequate English translation of it published.
Yes, yes. And so that was, you know, that was the feeling of many people, that the key person in the founding of Israel was Adolf Hitler and his actions and so forth. And he totally supported the transfer agreement. As I recall, even in 1938, some of the German generals said, let's quit doing this. Let's quit helping to fund the Zionists in Palestine. And Hitler said, no, we're going to continue.
And the only thing that interfered with it was when they invaded Poland and instigated World War II in 1939, September of 1939. But even after that, the Gestapo helped to facilitate the emigration of German Jews to Palestine. And they wanted German Jews, especially because German Jews were highly educated professionals who could form the stock to create the new nation. Edwin Black, in his book, The Transfer Agreement, said that 60,000 sophisticated German Jews were brought to Palestine through the transfer agreement, and they were the ones who formed the backbone of the new nation.
Okay.
And provided the highly sophisticated, highly educated stock that was necessary to build the nation.
Yeah, and especially Jewish people that are listening, I would urge you to get the book Perfidy by Ben Heck. Now, Ben Heck was an assistant screenwriter on Gone with the Wind with David O. Selznick. In Farewell to Arms, the movie, Ben Heck's name comes on the screen as big as the screen right before they get to the title, because he was a top Jewish screenwriter, and he raised a lot of money for the founding of Israel. But when he saw how the leaders of Israel were dealing with the Jews in captivity leading up to the founding of Israel after World War II, he wrote this book, Perfidy, about how horrible the Jewish leaders were acting. And I urge you to get that to see what Christopher and I are talking about, that everything did not, you know, it's proven in that book that the Nazis and the Zionists were cooperating hand in glove, and even hiding that they were cooperating in many ways. And
it was worse than just cooperation. The Zionist leaders were coming to the Jewish masses of Hungary as if they were their friends and lying to them and telling them that they were simply going to be transported to new camps where they would be safe from the war conflict. And the Zionist Jews were encouraging the Jewish masses to load up on the cattle cars and go to the concentration camps.
Yeah, and that's where also Rabbi Moshe Schoenfeld, I believe, wrote Holocaust Victims Accused. And he was in his book saying how the Jewish police in Germany were helping Hitler round up the Jews. The Jewish police were helping round up the Jews and turn them over to the Nazis. So we have all
kinds
of...
They were Sonderkommandos in the ghettos and in the concentration camps were all Jewish. Most of them were communists and Zionists.
Yes, and a lot of the information we have are Jewish individuals complaining that this was the state of affairs and their fellow Jews were helping Hitler to round up their parents and so on and so forth. We have a lot of sources in the videos at in the video and the audio that was turned into a YouTube video at HitlerDVD.com. If you want to research those. Again, that's an anti-Hitler website because we named it HitlerDVD.com because it was easy to remember in the days of DVDs. So let's talk about Versailles, which set the stage. Now, so in other words, if everybody's following, if Hitler had not existed, they would have found somebody else to take Hitler's place. In other words, he was filling in the role that that was called for in the book, The Jewish State in 1896. Right? Do you agree with that? They would have found somebody else.
100%. And the they that you're referring to were the big Zionist Jews, the Jewish bankers who wanted to establish the state of Palestine. But they operated through the premier German general of World War I, General Erich Ludendorff. And he had an assistant named Captain Karl Meyer, who was involved in the German intelligence forces that took over Bavaria after the failed communist revolution that Hitler participated in. And Hitler participated in the Bavarian communist revolution as a communist.
Right.
He was a liaison to the soldiers' councils for the Communist Party, initially under the socialist Kurt Eisner, who conducted the Bavarian Revolution. And then it became, when Eisner was assassinated, became the Bavarian Soviet Republic, which was led by a Jewish Leninist Bolshevik named Eugen Levine. And Douglas Reed was told that when Hitler was captured by the Freikorps, who liberated Bavaria from this communist revolution, he was found together with Eugen Levinet's bodyguard, that they were captured together and that Hitler was that close to Eugen Levinet, the Jewish Leninist communist dictator of Bavaria.
So this is about 1919, and Hitler is working with the communists, which had briefly taken over Munich. So that's a thing that the Hitler worshippers cannot explain. They never try to explain it. They just try to avoid discussion of it.
And Hitler hid the fact when he wrote Mein Kampf, but he did not hide the fact that he was recruited as an informant by Captain Karl Meyer and was put through instruction courses on how to become an anti-Semitic, anti-Bolshevik demagogue. And this was done because Erich Ludendorff wanted to create a German Joan of Arc who would create a national socialist revolution against the Weimar Republic, which was established after the Versailles Treaty. So Ludendorff ordered Captain Karl Meyer to order Adolf Hitler to infiltrate and take over Anton Drexler's German Workers' Party and turn it into the National Socialist German Workers' Party. And anybody who knows anything about communism and socialism knows that parties which call themselves workers' parties are communist parties.
Yeah. Now, since we got into it this far, let me mention to people something. I took every history course I could at St. Xavier High School, which was the 28th top high school in the country then based on SAT scores, and Xavier University. And I never heard this. Dr. Riznowski told me about it, and I had to look it up in the Encyclopedia Britannica to verify that it was true, because I couldn't believe I hadn't heard it. At the end of World War I, the communists, or the bankers behind the communists in Russia said, let's just march right across Europe right now. Everybody's exhausted from the war. We'll take over all of Europe right now. And the Russians started marching, and of course they always have machine guns to the backs of these soldiers, so if they turn around they're going to get killed for sure. And they were marching, and they got stopped in Poland. It was kind of a semi-miracle, because they said the Poles were dealing with forks and hand instruments, and the Russians were better armed. But they put up such a fight that enough confusion broke out that the Russian soldiers shot all the people with machine guns on them and walked back to Russia. They didn't care about taking over Europe. So knowing that they were coming, though, the communists in Poland and Hungary, especially in Hungary, they took over Munich and I think another city. And when I did learn that in college, in high school, and I thought, I wonder why they just out of the blue took over Munich. and then they were eventually thrown out after the Russians were stopped. Well, the reason was they expected the Russians to march through Poland and be in Hungary within a few weeks, and they were then going to have already control of Munich, and they were going to be ready to be the rulers of Hungary. Well, when the Russians were stopped and turned around and went home, then, of course, they were overthrown. And that explains, and in that period, that's where Hitler was working with the communists that were going to take over Hungary. And there's no explanation for this, except that Hitler was a guy looking for his spot in the sky, you know, his destiny. He wanted to be somebody important. And he thought at that time it was best to work with the communists. But then afterwards, when the communists were overthrown, for some reason, Hitler was kind of let go. And he then became started to become the leader of the Nazis. And when in the book, The Prisoner of Ottawa, where Douglas Reed was interviewing
Otto Strasser.
Otto Strasser. I'm having real name problems since I had some kind of a 10-day exhaustion. But okay, so when Douglas Reed was interviewing Otto Strasser, who was banished to Canada and had been a competitor of Hitler's in Germany, he said the three things that people would wonder about when they were talking about Hitler when he was on the rise in the 20s to be head of the Nazi Party was his kind of murky birth, where his birth came from, why he was working with the communists in Munich in 1919 or so, and at this time he said in Hitler's murky death, but that was much later. But he was saying they would talk about that in the 20s. Why was Adolf working with the communists in Munich? And they would just kind of shrug their shoulders and go on, you know. And David Irving is on BitChute, one of the little clips of him, and he's sympathetic to Hitler in many ways. But he said when he was that he had found that when the Nazi Party was on the rise in the 20s, they were heavily funded and essentially funded by two bankers in Berlin. And he said, I don't want to say what religion those bankers were because I don't want to be accused of anti-Semitism. So
he had found proof of that, actually, in a letter from the German Chancellor Brüning to Winston Churchill.
Yes, yes.
And in that letter, Brüning, who was Chancellor of Germany and strongly anti-Nazi, said that the two biggest funders of the Nazi Party were Jewish, and one of them was the leader of Zionism in Germany.
Mm-hmm. Yes, yes, that's on BitChute still. And thank you for reminding me of that. And Churchill even wanted to include that in his 6-volume set that it was published by, I think, Simon & Schuster. And Simon & Schuster vetoed it and said it could not go in the book.
Yes, they suppressed it.
Yeah, so Churchill occasionally would have a moment of clarity. But so now let's talk about Versailles as a setup for Hitler or whoever, you know, whoever was going to be the anti-Semitic media leader turned out to be Hitler. Let's talk about how the Versailles Treaty, which was was that also in 1919 or 1918?
1919.
Okay, so the Versailles Treaty, Douglas Reed had written that the Versailles Treaty was Jewish businessmen in pinstripe suits who were essentially representing every country. And that was set up to put such a heavy burden on Germany that Germans would be glad to see some like Hitler come along and start taking up their part. But can you talk about that, how Versailles was like a guarantee of World War II?
The whole thing was engineered exactly as you say. The Paris Peace Conference was primarily a gathering of very prominent Jews who decided the fate of Germany and reneged on Wilson's 14 points. Germany was in a position to keep the war going, but essentially surrendered and ceased military operations on the promise of American President Woodrow Wilson and his 14 points that Germany would lose no territory and would maintain its government, its monarchy, and its national integrity. And all of that was reneged upon by this gathering of Jews at the Paris Peace Conference, who imposed the Treaty of Versailles on Germany. The pretext that they used for this draconian, punitive set of measures against Germany was the fact that Ludendorff and Trotsky had agreed to the Treaty of Brest-Litovsk, which essentially gave a large swath of the Soviet Union over to Germany to create an Eastern Empire, which Germany then promptly lost through the Treaty of Versailles. There was a wealthy Jewish businessman who then, after the Treaty of Versailles, wanted to build up the German military in preparation for World War II. His name was Walter Rathenau. He created the Treaty of Rapallo, whereby the Germans started building heavy armor and airplanes in the Soviet Union in preparation for the war with the Soviet Union. So all of this, as you indicated, was a setup that the First World War was definitely to lead into the Second World War. And there were even cartoons immediately after the Treaty of Versailles mocking the fact that the leaders, Wilson, David Lloyd George, and Georges Clemenceau in France, had conspired to create conditions which would force Germany to instigate World War II.
And wasn't there impossible financial obligations on Germany?
Oh, absolutely. They lost territory. France was permitted to come into the Rhineland and enslave the Germans and use them as slave labor. There were tremendous reparations payments, which Germany was not only unable to pay, but forced into a situation where they couldn't pay because their industry was inhibited. There was a naval blockade by the British north of Germany, which starved 750,000 Germans to death. The leading financiers created a system in Germany which created the hyperinflation, and then they set it up so that they could obtain German loans in German currency, then change that German currency into foreign currency, and then after the hyperinflation, pay it back with hyperinflated German marks. And they made tremendous profits, all of this at the expense of the German people.
Was the German
government... German middle class was gutted by the fact that the many of them Jews created department stores and corporate farms, which eliminated the middle class in Germany. And this was done to instigate communist revolution and discontent in Germany.
And was the German government at that time in the 20s, were they kind of acquiescing to all this or fighting it or what?
They were fully in bed with them. It was the Weimar Republic, and it was a socialist government, which again had been put into power deceitfully to unseat Kaiser Wilhelm II and replace the monarchy with a socialist government. In many respects, World War I was a massive socialist revolution that put communists in charge of the Russian Empire, dismantled the Ottoman Empire so that Palestine could be taken by the British, dismantled the Austrian-Hungarian Empire, the Bavarian monarchy, and the Prussian monarchy over all of Germany was dismantled, and the Weimar Republic replaced it with a socialist government.
Okay, so when people say to me, the pro-Hitler people, they say, yeah, but look what Hitler did for Germany. From 1933 to 1939 may have been the greatest rise from ashes to a strong country in the history of the world. See what Hitler did for Germany. And I say that was part of the plan. That part of the plan is enunciated, and you actually found the plan, which is the 1896 book by Theodor Herzl, The Jewish State. And the idea was to crush Germans so unjustly that they were ready for a Hitler to come along and speak up for them. And this was part of the plan. And Germany rising from the ashes was part of the plan.
Yes, that's what Rathenau began to set up before he was assassinated, by allowing the Germans to sidestep the Treaty of Versailles and build up their military in the Soviet Union. And the economic miracle that you're discussing was implemented by a man named Hjalmar Schacht, who was a prominent Freemason in bed with the prominent Jewish financiers. And Hitler railed against Freemasonry, banned it, but the economic miracle that you described from 33, especially 35 to 38 was were the best years, was engineered by this Freemason banker.
Well,
and it was done so that the military could be built up. You needed to have a strong military in order for the Germans to think that they had a chance at taking over the Soviet Union and waging a war against the Soviet Union. If they had not built up that military, World War II would not have happened, and they desperately wanted World War II to happen. And Stalin also helped to finance Hitler's war machine. And Hitler was known in the Soviet Union as the icebreaker for the revolution. Even before Hitler came to power, that was his code name among the Soviets, was the icebreaker. And by that, they meant that they would build up Hitler so that he would instigate a war and persecute Jews. And that war would spread out throughout all of Eastern Europe, weaken them so that they couldn't resist the communists. And then Stalin would come in as the great hero to denazify Eastern Europe and take it all over as a communist empire with the full support of the Western allies, who would view him as the savior of the Jews, who was bringing communism to denazify Eastern Europe and bring peace to the world. These plans were openly discussed in the 1930s. And there's a book on it by Viktor Suvorov called Icebreaker, Who Started the Second World War, which discusses all of this. And there was the president of Czechoslovakia, Edvard Beneš, in the mid-30s was talking about the fact that Hitler would start this war and then the Soviet Union would expand to Czechoslovakia's borders. And he was exchanging letters with the leaders of the Soviet Union discussing this and stating that he welcomed it and he wanted the Soviet Union as his neighbor so that he would no longer be threatened by Germany.
But what you're saying is, while it was all kind of a big joke because the people behind the scenes were all fully in harmony with what was happening.
Yes, he was funded by Warburg, AEG, ITT, IG Farben, the immensely wealthy Jewish Austrian philosopher Ludwig Wittgenstein gave the Nazis 1.7 tons of gold.
Wow, and where is that? What's the source on that?
Oh, that's very well known. If you simply Google Wittgenstein, Wittgenstein, and 1.7 tons of gold, I'm sure you'll find it, or Wittgenstein and Nazis. It's not controversial. It's not disputed.
And remember that the Bank of Settlements in Switzerland was processing all of Hitler's purchases and so forth. In other words, they were not trying to block Hitler like they have done a few other lesser during World War II, I mean.
And the entire scandal of President Hindenburg, who had the constitutional authority to appoint a chancellor, appointing Adolf Hitler, was instigated by the Jewish banker Kurt von Schroeder, who was of the J.H. Stein banking house in Cologne. He arranged for von Papen to meet with Hitler and Hitler's associates and agree to a deal where Hitler would be appointed chancellor by Hindenburg and then would appoint von Papen into his government and some of the other Jewish bankers' puppets as part of his new Nazi government. The entire thing was arranged by Jewish bankers.
Going back to the point on Hitler railing against the Freemasons, there's a book by Bullock called Hitler and Stalin, Parallel Lives. And Stalin did the same thing. They outlawed Freemasonic lodges because they realized that that is where one source of trying to overthrow them would come. So the fact that they both railed against Freemasons once they got power was simply to avoid, try to avoid any attempts to overthrow them from that quarter.
But they still allowed the Zionists to wave their flags and publish their party organ, which is an amazing fact.
Yeah, and which shows that the Freemasonry is the junior, I think it's always, at least for the last few hundred years, been the junior partner of the Zionist Jews. But, okay, so here's Germany's head is having their face rubbed in dirt on all fronts, and here comes Adolf Hitler, and he's screaming.
He is the German Joan of Arc that General Erich Ludendorff created. And there was an article published by Captain Karl Meyer in November of 1941 in the magazine Current History, which is titled, I Was Hitler's Boss. And if people put I Was Hitler's Boss in quotations into a search engine, they'll find this article. And in this article, Karl Meyer lays out the fact that Hitler was this informant for the German intelligence in Bavaria who was sent in to infiltrate the Anton Drexler's German Workers' Party on the orders of Erich Ludendorff and create National Socialism. And that was another one of the things that Otto Strasser talked about in his books, was his meeting with Ludendorff and with Hitler, where Ludendorff was promoting National Socialism. And this was a man who was supposed to be a monarchist.
Now, according to Michael Hoffman of Revisionist History, and he's written a number of books, he says that Hess, I can't remember the first name right now, the fellow named Hess. What, Rudolph?
You're talking about the man who flew to Scotland.
No. I'm talking about the guy in 1825, around 100 years before.
Oh, Moses Hess, the author of Rome and Jerusalem, who created National Socialism. That was one of the things I wrote about in my book in 2006. Essentially, Hess created the whole concept of National Socialism.
Right.
And in his book, Rome and Jerusalem, he promoted the idea that there should be a race war of extermination between the Jews and the Germans.
And he said they needed National Socialism, International Socialism, which is communism, and Zionism. They needed to have all three movements, I believe he wrote about back then, to accomplish getting control of
The first one to, it wasn't called Zionism at the time, but to establish the idea of the restoration of the Jews on a racial basis instead of a religious basis.
Okay.
And on a political basis instead of religious basis. And he said that the Jewish people itself must become its own Messiah.
Mm-hmm.
And that the only people who would oppose this would be the Germans, and therefore the Germans had to be eliminated in a race war.
Okay.
And this was, I think, 1869 or thereabouts.
Okay. Yeah, that's it. Okay.
And he was involved initially in the 1840s with Karl Marx and setting up communism. So he helped to engineer both communism and Zionism,
mm-hmm.
and created the concept of National Socialism,
right?
Which
Austrian
Jews found its way to Hitler.
Right. Hoffman wrote about that, and you wrote about that. Okay. Now, how popular was Hitler? I read one account when he was, after he had become Chancellor of Germany, and maybe had been recognized as the Führer by this point, where he flew into a rally of thousands and thousands of people and he spoke, and then he got on the plane and they started to fly out of there. And the people in the audience did the Heil Hitler salute quietly. They stood there quietly doing the Heil Hitler salute until the plane disappeared, until the plane got so far away from them that it disappeared. That was the level of loyalty that Hitler had, because he was bringing the German people back. He was giving them back the dignity that any nation would want. But I contend, and I think you do too, this was part of the plan. This was part of the plan so that they would follow him into the disastrous military moves that we're about to discuss.
He was initially a crude speaker, and he was trained by Captain Karl Meyer and the Reichswehr on how to give speeches.
Mm-hmm.
And in 1919 and 1920, the German military would send in a claque of German soldiers who pretended to be civilians, and they would applaud for Hitler vociferously. And initially, Hitler was viewed as a comedian spoofing anti-Semites, and there were newspaper articles about this ridiculing him. But he polished up his act, and he was trained by the military on how to do it. And then later, he was trained by a Jewish stage performer, Jan Hannesen, or something like that, I forget his name now, who taught him the art of mesmerizing crowds.
Uh-huh.
So he was actually schooled by the German military and then by this famous Jewish stage performer on how to mesmerize crowds. And he was always funded by these covert groups that would put in audiences who would applaud for him initially. It wasn't necessary once he became chancellor, but initially it was. And it, in that article, I Was Hitler's Boss, he talks about how they would pay for beer and free sausage for the starving Germans to come and watch Hitler rant on stage.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Well, you know, Frank Sinatra's people did the same thing. They would send hire screaming girls in his initial performances. But at any rate, so
well, this is the level of psychological warfare that was waged on the German people.
Yes, yes, yes. Let's go to so again. While there was plenty of killing, and I always say the Nazis and Hitler didn't care how many Jews died of starvation or overworking or other causes, but the Holocaust is essentially Hitler getting, he's not trying to kill all 6 million Jews, as is the popular thing. He's trying to get as many as possible Jewish people down to Palestine in preparation of the takeover. But he also, I think, as we've talked before the show here, they also wanted a certain number of Jews to die for sure, to get rid of some of them, like the Orthodox, the Hasidic, and so forth. And also, they wanted some basis. They wanted to definitely have a basis for the idea that there was a Holocaust trying to kill all Jews. But comment on that a little bit about what essentially was Hitler doing in those years of 1933 to 1945, or 1939 to 1945.
He was rounding up the largest populations of Jews in Europe by far, were in the former Russian Empire, which was one of the reasons that he wanted to invade and was one of the reasons why the Austrian Jews created the concept of Lebensraum, so that they could utilize the Germans as a hammer to get rid of the Tsar, and that they could then draw Germany as a military force into in a war against Pan-Slavism. They wanted the Pan-Germans to go into Eastern Europe and round up and concentrate all of the Jews and persecute them so that they would feel an incentive to move to Palestine after this war had concluded and the Germans had been defeated. The Germans, Eichmann famously stated that when he went into Poland and went into Warsaw and found the ghettos already existed and they had been created by the Jews centuries before because they would run wires from one house to the next to remain in segregated communities. So all he had to do was brick in those ghettos which already existed and then transplant anti-Zionist Jews into those ghettos where they would then congregate with Eastern European Zionist Jews and become reaccustomed to the idea that they were Jewish, that Jews would be persecuted in Europe, and that the only resolution to this dilemma was Theodor Herzl's resolution, which was for the Jews to leave Europe and go to Palestine. So as you indicated, the whole process created the conditions whereby the Jews would be concentrated into a large mass that would then be incentivized to leave Europe forever, go to Palestine, and stay there forever. There were only 600,000 Jews, supposedly, in Germany, and those were the best Jews, the most well-educated, the most sophisticated, the most modern Jews. And those were the ones who were essentially forced through the transfer agreement to emigrate into Palestine. Then during the war, the effort changed from trying to transport Jews to trying to terrorize Jews and the world and to emphasize Herzl's theme that the only resolution to the conflict between Jews and Gentiles was separation and the formation of a Jewish state. And that became the theme after the war, that due to this Holocaust, the Jews therefore had a right to steal Palestine from the Palestinians and establish a Jewish state on Palestinian soil, even though the Palestinians had nothing to do with the war.
Right. And there was a Polish girl named Dana Alvey, who I think ended up in California. She has to be dead by now, but she was a young girl like of 15 or something at the end of the war, 1945. And she was in the camps because there were not only Jews in the camps. And So she said Jewish speakers from Russia and the United States came in and were saying to the, you know, to the group and to the Jews there, Europe has become a hostile place for Jews, so you've got to come down to Palestine. They were trying to make sure that as many of them as possible did.
And if I may interject, the Zionists were permitted into the camps to select Zionist Jews to leave the camps and were then given government funds to go from Germany and from the concentration camps to Palestine. But non-Zionist Jews were not granted those privileges.
Aha. Mm-hmm. So, yeah. So
it became a process of natural selection where only the fittest survive. And I think I have a unique theory that one of the aspects of the Holocaust was it was a eugenics program. I quote articles from the early 20th century where the Jews were discussing the fact that only older Jews were having children and they were waiting too long to have children and that there was too much interbreeding among Jews and they were becoming inbred and they were obtaining genetic defects. So they required a eugenics program to select out both naturally and artificially the best, fittest Jews to found the Jewish nation. And that's what the Zionists did. And they would go into the camps. They didn't want the old people. They didn't want the children. They only wanted fit adults who were capable of building a new nation and conquering the Arabs. And those were the people that they artificially selected by having Zionists come in and say, I want this guy, that guy, and that guy. The other ones stay. And by imposing disease and starvation on the populations in the concentration camps, which led to natural selection, which killed off the old, the weak, the infirm, and the idiots and insane.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. If I could go, since we've been
and this
talking-
went along with the Nazi T4 euthanasia program, where they also had that same eugenics idea.
Mm-hmm.
So it was in the atmosphere. It was the zeitgeist of the German Empire at that time. And it was in perfect keeping with the attitudes of many people, not simply the Zionist Jews, that this was necessary, that because civilization had advanced to the point where there was no longer any natural selection going on, there had to be some means of imposing it to undo the damage that the segregation of the Jews had done for 2,000 years, where they were forced into ghettos, where they were interbreeding within their own families in incestuous marriages, and they had to undo that genetic damage.
Yeah, and whole groups, as led by, for instance, Margaret Sanger in the United States, agreed with this. They had to kind of go underground after they had the Nuremberg trials, though, and pretend that they were not for this type of thing for a few decades. But now you see it emerging again, this kind of urging of a government facilitated natural selection. Before we leave the camps, I wanted to say what most people and I found incredible when I first heard it. When the camps were first starting and the Nazis were rounding up the Jews, they had in the camps their own money, orchestras. They had maternity wards for the women that were hospitals. In other words, if you just wanted to kill 6 million Jews, as soon as they got there, you could machine gun them and put them in a ditch or whatever, you know, whatever other methods might be used. But that was not the original concentration camps before the war broke out. That did have these aspects to them.
Well, there were different types of concentration camps that evolved. The ones that were the most amenable were ones like Theresienstadt, where they had theaters, they had sports grounds, and the idea was that the Jews that were in there were being segregated. They would eventually, as Julius Streicher admitted in the Nuremberg trials, the whole idea was that the ultimate solution, the final solution, would be Zionism, and that these Jews were given the opportunity to continue to study and to provide the Reich with their scientific benefits and other things, and they were simply segregated so that they would not breed with Germans. And there was also the fact that in 1933, Samuel Untermeyer and other big Jews issued a declaration of war against the Germans, and the Germans were fearful of that and believed that they had to segregate this hostile population, that Jews in the Soviet Union had mass murdered 30 million people by 1923, and they did not want to suffer a similar fate. And then in 1940, there was an American Jew named Theodor Neumann, who published a book calling for the extermination of the German people called Germany Must Perish. And it was promoted by the Roosevelt administration. It received mention in the New York Times. And then in Germany, Goebbels and his propaganda apparatus promoted the idea that the Jews were engaging in a war of extermination and that the Germans had to defend themselves from this international Jewish attack, which would lead to the extermination of the Jewish people. And that was supposedly what instigated the Wannsee conference with Reinhard Heydrich, who was part Jewish, to set up the convert the camps into death camps.
So you say they had a conference to talk about converting the camps into death camps. Explain that a little more.
That was the infamous Wannsee conference. I think it was 1942, where they established what was called the final solution, and the final solution would be gassing all the Jews. And all of that documentation has been disputed, but that is the official narrative. But it was the, if it is true, it was the product of the German response instigated by Goebbels to Theodor Neumann's book, Germany Must Perish.
Okay. Now, Dr. Wisnowski felt that Goebbels may have been Jewish. What is your thought on that?
According to Hennecke Kardell, he was referred to as the little rabbi in school. He was had a friend who made him a Russophile and a communist. His two favorite professors at Heidelberg University were both Jewish. He had a Jewish girlfriend that he wanted strongly to marry when he was a young man. And then his wife, Magda Goebbels, was the daughter of a German Jew named Friedlander. So his children, his daughters, were all Mischlinge, part Jews. Mm-hmm. Whether he himself was Jewish or not, I don't know.
Okay.
But there are allegations that he was, certainly.
Okay, now let's go.
And he himself, Goebbels, accused Leni Riefenstahl of being Jewish.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So let's go on now to the Hitler's war effort.
And Goebbels, I again apologize for interrupting, but Goebbels in his diary said that Germany, Jewry, communism, I am a German communist, or words to that effect. He said that he was a communist and he was a Russophile. His favorite author was Dostoevsky. In the Spanish Civil War, he felt betrayed that the Russians were fighting with German proxies in Spain, and he welcomed the idea of communism and revolution. He was against the bourgeoisie. He was against Western Europe and America, and he wanted to support the idea of Germany uniting in a greater revolution with the Soviets.
Okay.
He was a very red Nazi, like Ernst Röhm, like the Strasser brothers, Otto and Gregor Strasser.
Okay, let's go on to the war now and Hitler's unexplainable moves, in my opinion. Hitler railed in his speeches against England and the USA being controlled by powerful Zionist Jews. And then when they went to war with England, then I can't remember the German general's name, but the Germans were moving on much faster than anybody expected. And they bottled up the British Navy at Dunkirk. And as
the expeditionary forces.
Okay. And as they were going there, then they started to get orders from, I can't remember if it was Himmler or who, stop, stop, stop. And the German general leading the German army, he said, well, these must be wrong orders, and he kept going. Then finally Hitler got involved and said, stop, stop, stop. And they stopped and basically let the English forces go at Dunkirk. And the diaries on both sides were incredible. The Germans couldn't believe that Hitler was letting them go, and the British couldn't believe that they were being allowed to go back to England. Now, had the Hitler worshippers say, well, he thought that England was such an important, the English Empire was such an important part of Western civilization that he didn't want to destroy them. The problem with that is had he kept them bottled up there, gone into England and overthrown Churchill and put someone friendly to England instead of to the Jewish bankers, then he could have, you know, ousted the top Zionists from ruling England. Instead, he lets them have their forces back and keeps the war going. So I consider that to be a unique thing in military history, where you have a nation defeated and you go ahead and let them go. And again, there's the Hitler worshippers will say, well, he just wanted to remain friends with the British Empire, and so he let them go, to hoping that they would be friends after that. I consider that ridiculous, and I think it's that Hitler knew of the bigger plan and knew that this was not part of the plan. They have England, so he let them go as a sign of that he could, as a guy that the top bankers could work with. That's my take on it. What is your take on Dunkirk?
In terms of the history of events, I agree with your analysis. There were several halt issues, orders issued, as there later would be when he attacked Moscow and issued a halt order at Smolensk and then split his forces. They had made their way through France. They surrounded them, the Belgian, the Dutch, and the English and French troops at Dunkirk. The Dunkirk pocket was completely surrounded, could have been easily defeated. Hitler's duty was to the German people, not the British people. He was involved in a war. The objective of a war is to defeat the enemy quickly. He could have minimized British and German casualties by ending the war at that point by taking the troops in the Dunkirk pocket. Instead, he issued the halt order. And then he allowed Hermann Göring, who was in charge of the Luftwaffe, to take over all operations. The British started to send every ship that they had, commercial ships, small fishing boats, everything to bring across the English Channel to recover the expeditionary force and the Belgian forces and bring them to England for a future fight, which happened on D-Day. And Goebbels insisted that the Reichswehr, the Wehrmacht, would halt all their operations, and the Luftwaffe would take over and start to bomb the ships. And then the British Air Force essentially destroyed the German Air Force, and Hitler refused to send in ground troops to halt all of these operations. There were also plans for something called Operation Seawolf, where Hitler would send forces across the channel to take over England, and all of that got scrubbed. So he deliberately sabotaged the German war effort and ensured the fact that the British would remain on their island and preserve themselves and eventually defeat Hitler. Germans in general were not Anglophiles. There's an old German slur, Inselaffen. They refer to the British as island apes. There was great dislike between the two nations because of the First World War, and the idea that Hitler would put the interests of the British after the First World War above the interests of the Germans is patently absurd and a ridiculous excuse for him for the fact that he sabotaged his own war efforts and ensured the ultimate victory of the Allies. He did exactly the same thing in Operation Barbarossa. He issued a halt order at Smolensk and split his forces north and south when he should have driven straight to Moscow and taken it before winter hit.
Yeah, let me. I wanted to mention next Operation Barbarossa and all the stuff that you're now talking about. Let me say one thing though. You have four books written and published, and you have several more on the way. So let's, in what volume do you describe the Dunkirk thing? Let's just go over your books real quickly right now, okay?
Okay. I have a book series, excuse me, which people can find on my website, cjbbooks.com.
My initials,
CJB,
no.
Yes.
The CJB is your initials, Christopher John Bjergner, CJB Books. So there's two B's in that. CJBbooks.com. Okay.
Correct. Thank you. And the book series is called Adolf Hitler, Bolshevik, and Zionist. Volume 1 addresses communism, and that is where I talk about how Goebbels and Hitler sabotaged the German war effort, how Hitler's secretary, Bormann, was a Soviet spy. There was the Lucy spy ring, which was a communist Soviet spy organization within the Nazi party. There was the Rota Capella, which Goering was very close to, which was another spy organization. Heinrich Müller, who was very close to Hitler too, was a Soviet spy. Hitler and Bormann were sending radio transmissions out of Berlin to Stalin, informing him of all of the Nazis' plans. And the SS discovered these and was forced to suppress the fact that Hitler's higher-ups were transmitting radio messages informing the Soviets of all of the Germans' plans in the Eastern Front. They were rotten with spies, and the SS did nothing about it, could do nothing about it, because Hitler would have had them all murdered. That is discussed in Volume 1, which is Communism.
Wait a minute, for when people get to your website, cjbbooks.com, what is the whole series called?
Adolf Hitler, Bolshevik, and Zionist.
That's what the whole series is called.
Right. And then Volume 1 is Communism, Volume 2 is Zionism, Volume 3 is World War I, because World War II grew out of World War I. And then Volume 5 is Premonitions, where I republish all of the forecasts of the Holocaust that have been made for the past 2,500 years.
Okay. And then what about you have two books, you have two other books coming out, which we'll wait to see then, I guess. Okay. So that's where you can find four really meaty, all of them have, 200-300 pages or more, and very, very small print.
Yes, they are very well documented, and as you say, they are not little books.
Right.
They're hefty books.
Yes, they are. I have three of them. I got to get the fourth. Okay, now, the fourth that's published, which is number 5.
And I don't say these things lightly. I don't say these things out of any malice. Quite the contrary. I am warning people that there are very powerful people in the world who set this up.
Yeah.
And most of them were Jewish, and they betrayed their own Jewish people to this fate, which indicates what they're willing to do, not only to Jewish people, but to humanity at large.
And they got some other, along with their Freemasonic allies like the Clintons and the Bushes, they got some really bad plans in progress right now, trying to use fear of a virus or whatever to enslave us. Their goal is still world communism, with them running it, and we're the victims of, basically looked at as animals, no rights in court, no right to own property, and basically can be treated like animals as far as they're concerned, is how I see it. And they got a lot of plans for mankind that are still in progress.
And Chaim Weizmann and Winston Churchill established this mythology that there is an opposition between communism and Bolshevism, and the world has to choose between one or the other and work for either camp. But both are forwarding the Jewish messianic agenda to establish a global government which is centered in Jerusalem as the Supreme Court of mankind, as
yeah.
David Ben-Gurion stated.
Yeah, and if I may mention, we can cut this out if you don't want it, Christopher. That's why I paused there a minute. But I wanted to mention, let me just say it, and then if you don't want it in, we'll cut it out. And, you know, to show the intellectual honesty and objectivity of Christopher John Bjerknes, his grandfather from Sweden was Jewish, so he's one-fourth Jewish. So it's kind of like me, I'm a Catholic, but I can't stand the men who we call anti-popes and non-bishops that are occupying the Vatican and the bishops' chairs around the world now and the structures of the Catholic Church. In fact, I want the death penalty for the bishops and priests that perpetuated the pedophilia. But in like manner, Christopher is, though being one-fourth Jewish, is able to be very objective on the criminals that are also Jewish that are leading a lot of this revolution.
Yes, it is extremely important for these facts to be widely known.
Yes.
Because as Jim often says, this is utilized as a brickbat to indemnify the criminals who perpetrated this crime against humanity, all of humanity.
And if you identify these relative handful of criminals, and they're maybe 500,000 allies, whatever, because they issue money. But if you identify these few criminals, they want to say, you're against all the Jewish people. You're against the people that we persecuted during World War II. That's not what we're saying. We're saying we're against these criminals, and there's probably about 300 bankers, whatever. They are the ones that need to be arrested, and then mankind can go on without anybody trying to put everybody else under a slavery.
And we have an obligation to the truth. We have to inform people of the facts.
And to our fellow men as well. Right. Exactly. Yeah.
Absolutely. It's a matter of integrity.
Right. So let's go on to the Operation Barbarossa and all around that. Now, maybe I don't understand this, but here's my understanding. Then you correct me if I don't got it right. Hitler invades Russia, which I look at as an iffy proposition. Of course, you're saying now they wanted to get at a lot of the Jews that were in Russia, the everyday Jews. But so they go there and they get to the point where the German soldiers are within the view of capturing Moscow. Now, I always thought if you're fighting a war, the worst thing that you could do to the other side is capture their capital, which is where I guess Stalin was, or that was the capital. Moscow was the capital. And instead of letting the Germans capture the capital, again, Hitler, through somebody else, says stop. The German soldiers don't believe it. Then Hitler gets involved. But before he did, I think it was Himmler who said, we'll supply you every day. And the general said, how much do we need every day? And he said, 300 pounds. He said, we need 3,000 pounds. Well, anyway, what they ended up doing was the Germans stopped because of the order, and every last one of them was either killed or captured by the Soviets. So I looked at, again, Hitler sabotaging his own forces at that point when they could have maybe taken Moscow. So that's my understanding of it, but I don't claim to have a real expert understanding of it, but go ahead and comment on that.
I think you're mixing part of what happened at Stalingrad with what happened at Moscow.
Okay.
Initially, the forces of Army Group A and Army Group B were headed straight towards Moscow because, as you say, it is essential. And all the German generals insisted that the first objective should be to capture the capital, because it would destroy the morale, it would take out the command and control center of the Soviet armies, and it would gain tremendous momentum for the Nazi effort to conquer the Soviet Union. And Hitler did issue a halt order at Smolensk so that supposedly the armies could regroup, resupply, and then he split his armies north and south instead of taking Moscow. Now, what that did was that fulfilled Stalin's plan for Hitler to spread his armies across all of Eastern Europe so that when Hitler started to retreat, the Soviets would have a pretext to go into each of these different countries and conquer them and make them part of the Warsaw Pact and the Soviet bloc. And Hitler established what he called fortress cities, where he would trap his own soldiers in these cities in this vast, vast theater of war where they had no chance, and they would be surrounded by the Soviets. And then the Soviets would not only defeat the Germans, but they would take over those countries and then Bolshevize it, kill all the bourgeoisie, kill all of the ethnic Germans, the Volksdeutsche. Millions of Germans were slaughtered in Eastern Europe in this way, and Hitler set up the situation for it and ensured his defeat. And initially, all of this was put into play by the Ribbentrop-Molotov Pact to divide Poland between Germany and the Soviet Union on the pretext that if there was an alliance between Nazi Germany and the Soviet Union, England would never declare war on Germany because they would fear that alliance. But England had a treaty with Poland that if Poland were invaded, England would automatically declare war on whoever invaded Poland. And they declared war on Nazi Germany, but they did not declare war on the Soviet Union. Mm-hmm. So then Hitler entered into a war with England, but then he created a two-front war with Operation Barbarossa, which ensured his defeat, because then he had to fight not only the British, but the Soviets on both sides of Germany. And he knew from his experience in World War I that that was suicidal. And another thing that World War I taught the Germans was the von Schlieffen plan. Insisted that if Germany were to engage in a two-front war, it would have to utilize Blitzkrieg and take all of the territory very quickly because it would have no chance at winning a prolonged war. Uh-huh. And he violated that old von Schlieffen plan in Dunkirk when he allowed the pocket to escape and issued his halt order, and in Smolensk when he issued his halt order and failed to take Moscow. He uh-huh. ensured that there would be a prolonged war. And then he knew that when America entered the war in exchange for the Balfour Declaration in World War I, it ensured Germany's defeat. When the Japanese attacked America at Pearl Harbor, Hitler, who claimed that he never issued declarations of war, declared war on America, which dragged America into the war against Germany. America was not involved with the war in Europe and had no appetite for it until Hitler declared war on America. Well, and the pro-Hitler types say that Germany was obliged to do it because of its obligations with Japan, but Japan had already sabotaged its treaties with Germany by failing to attack the Soviet Union. Yeah. When Hitler went to war with the Soviet Union, the Japanese were obliged to attack the Soviets and force them to fight a two-front war, which would have been for the benefit of the Japanese, because then the Japanese could have defeated the Soviets. But the Japanese did not. And that enabled Stalin to transfer all his troops from the east to the west to fight against the Germans. So the Japanese had already betrayed Germany. And then Germany, supposedly as a matter of honor, declared war on the U.S. and ensured Germany's defeat in spite of its experience in the First World War.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up because I always say that, you know, as you know, Roosevelt was strangling Japan by blockading
oil
and things to their island. That's why they attacked the Soviet, that attacked us at Pearl Harbor, was to break that blockade. And in the West Coast, the radio stations were turning off their lights at night because they were sure Japan was going to come and attack the West Coast. But Japan only wanted to block the blockade, so they never did do that. So when that happened,
Roosevelt had foreknowledge that they were about to attack and did nothing because he wanted the attack to galvanize the American people for a war.
Right, and same with General George Catlett Marshall. They didn't warn, you know, they didn't warn the people, the soldiers and the Navy at Pearl Harbor. So at that point, Roosevelt could have only justified sending our troops against the Japanese. But 3 days later, I think, Hitler declares war on the United States, and Roosevelt, in fact, sent 90% of our troops and resources against Germany, because that was the goal, was to get in there against Germany. And later on, we sent stuff out to fight the Japanese. But initially, every 90% went over to fight Germany. And that couldn't have been possible if Hitler hadn't almost treasonously declared war on the United States when there was no reason to do so.
And not only no reason to do so, but no reason to support the Japanese who had failed in their obligations to help the Germans against the Soviets.
Right.
And the Americans were also supplying the Soviets with steel and all kinds of resources and weaponry, et cetera.
Yes, yes. And in reality, of course, the goal of the top bankers was always world communism. So they always wanted us to treat Uncle Joe Stalin, so-called, as if he was, doing good things around the world. But
and the same thing happened after, during and after World War I. Wilson sent Trotsky over to perpetrate the Bolshevik Revolution. Eric Ludendorff sent Lenin in to perpetrate the Bolshevik Revolution.
Right, right.
And the Soviet Union was falling apart, and we sent all kinds of aid to keep the Soviet Union going.
Right. And Trotsky was imprisoned. He was arrested in prison in Canada, and Bernard Baruch had Wilson send up, let him go so he could get over there for the Russian revolution.
And gave him a passport.
Yeah, gave him a passport.
And then intervened, I think it was in Sweden, in the consulates to allow Trotsky to go through with a bunch of East Side Jews from New York.
Right, right. As Disraeli, the first Jewish English prime minister in the 1860s or so, 1870s, he wrote in his book Coningsby, the world is ruled by very different personages than are imagined by those who are not behind the scenes. And now that all this is known, you can see that there was this shadow government operating behind all of the governments. A few other Hitler things that never made sense. As I understand it, a lot of the Slavs wanted to fight with Hitler, but he did not accept them. He did not recognize them as full Aryans or something like that, as Aryans. So he didn't recognize, and so he did not accept the help of a lot of the Slavs that wanted to help him. But he did declare the Japanese honorary Aryans. That was
that's a very good point. And a good example of what you're saying was Stepan Bandera in Ukraine instituted what was essentially a national socialist movement to chase out the Bolsheviks. And Hitler had him put in prison for the duration of the war. And the Ukrainian people looked to the Nazis as liberators. And then they started slaughtering and starving people the same as the Bolsheviks had. Not to the extent that the Bolsheviks had, but they were certainly not honorable allies of the Ukrainian people.
Yeah, yeah. There's a bunch of things like that. Now, also, a friend of mine's dad always said that Hitler could have dropped a few ships in the Straits of Gibraltar and stopped the Allies from getting into the Mediterranean Sea. But he didn't. And that was, at least I consider that to be a reasonable point of why didn't Hitler just drop some ships or other stuff into the Straits of Gibraltar to close it off to the Allies getting in there.
I haven't thought about that much. I don't really want to comment on that.
Okay.
I know that the British Navy and the American Navy were pretty strong.
Yeah, yeah. So at any rate, yeah, that's just something that might be further investigated into. Okay, so let's go over your...
And I'm not certain that Hitler didn't have submarines floating around in that area taking out shipping. So it would be something I would investigate before I would comment on it.
Okay, okay. So let's end up then, because we've covered a good smattering of things here. So cjbbooks.com is your website. Adolf Hitler, Bolshevik and Zionist is the general category. The books are Adolf Hitler, Communism, number 2, Adolf Hitler, Zionist, number 3, Adolf Hitler, World War I. And then number 5, which came out before number 4, Premonitions, of different references to the Holocaust going back thousands of years. And most interesting are probably the ones that came out in the last 40 years before World War II began.
Don Hedesheimer, I'm not sure how he pronounces his name, wrote a book called The First Holocaust.
Mm-hmm.
And he pointed out that from the 1890s onward, there were many, many stark warnings that exactly 6 million Jews faced a, quote, and they use the term Holocaust, exterminatory Holocaust for various reasons, Tsarist anti-Semitism, famine, and it hopped around from country to country, Poland, Ukraine, Russia, etc. But the figure most often given was exactly 6 million, and the term most often used was Holocaust. And this was from 1890s through the 1920s.
Yeah, and I saw some of that information, which is incredible. Your books were on Amazon and then were one day banned from Amazon. Is that right?
Yes, and then I went to Lulu and I got banned there, and now I'm back on Amazon.
Oh, you are back on Amazon. Okay. How about Barnes & Noble?
I suspect so, but I'm not sure. I don't know.
You don't know if you're on there or not. Okay.
But I also have them available as PDFs, so people can...
At your website or PDFs?
Yes, they can also buy them as PDF files for much less, and if they live in foreign countries, they can get them immediately and cheaply.
Yeah, that's good. That's good strategy. Okay. Okay, well, Christopher John Bjerknes, we've been interviewing, author, researcher. His website, again, which I highly recommend everyone visit, is cjbbooks.com. And Christopher, I greatly appreciate you taking the time to be on my radio show. Okay?
Thank you so much for keeping me in mind and for having me on. And please, let's do it again before, what has it been?
We need to do a video one, too. This is audio for radio, but we need to do a video one that we can put up. So, okay, very good.
It's been 15 years since the last interview, I guess.
Yeah, right.
I hope we're still around for the next one. Let's put it that way.
Yeah, we'll do it soon. Okay, thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Jim. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.